that should give you just a little bit of a clue who the guest of the Jazz Cat will be in a moment. I won't spoil it for you. But joining us in about 10 or 15 seconds will be Leroy Downs, the host of the Live with the Jazz Cat segment. I certainly encourage you to go to his website, as I've done many times before, but here it is again, www.thejazzcat.net. And what you'll find there at that website is just an array and an archive of great interviews that he's conducted over the last couple of years here on exclusively on KRML Jazz and Blues Radio, including some that, you know, people standing in line at the Grammy Awards. Dee Dee Bridgewater was there and at the home of Diane Reeves, and a lot of breaking news that behind the scenes. So this is all there, captured and archived by the Jazz Cat himself, Leroy Downs, on the Live with the Jazz Cat segment in a moment. So stay right here. We'll be right back with Live with the Jazz Cat, Leroy Downs and his guest on KRML Jazz and Blues Radio. Well, it's with great pleasure that I'm going to introduce this next individual, who is not only so well respected among the jazz scene, but also as my personal friend. And I can honestly say that his heart is always in the right place. I've known him for quite a while now, and it seems like it gets better and better, just like good wine. But without further ado, let me bring on Leroy Downs, the Jazz Cat himself, for his Live with the Jazz Cat segment, exclusively here on KRML Jazz and Blues Radio. Leroy.
Hey, Gary, how are you?
Hey, how's it going there?
Oh, beautiful. I'm having a great afternoon. And of course, all afternoons are great when you're involved in this music. We get a chance to speak to so many beautiful cats in the business, and this is one of them, one of the many Marcellus brothers, Mr. Delfio Marcellus.
Yes, sir.
How you doing, man?
Very good, very good.
Beautiful, beautiful. How's the weather out there in New Orleans?
Oh, it's nice, not too humid, not too sunny. We got some California weather.
Boy, hey, all right, California dreaming. Hey, you know, I've talked with a few musicians from New Orleans, and it seems like everyone's passed through the New Orleans Center for the Creative Arts.
Right.
When, how, and what sparked the love for the sound of the trombone for you?
Well, you know, I think that it's funny in my family that everyone who plays was attracted to the individual, to the instrument that's most closely, I would say, related to their personality. So I think that the trombone in the jazz band is kind of the organizer and kind of the keeper of the peace. So, you know, that early on, that was a sign for me.
Well, that's interesting. You know, I just like every chess piece has a different move. Every Marcellus brother has blossomed into a different sound. Was that Big Daddy Ellis's push to strive for individual, unique sound?
I think it was really, I guess, more the way that my mother stressed individuality. You know, they made sure that we participated in all the sporting, you know, basketball and baseball and football, and we were in the Boy Scouts, and we had so many different activities going on. But my mother always stressed that it was okay to be individual.
Yeah.
You know, and the story I like to always say is we all liked our eggs cooked differently. And, you know, she's preparing, so rather than just say, okay, everybody's eating scrambled today, she would prepare them all separately, individually, which, was kind of a sign of the things that she would do to make us realize it's okay to be individual.
Hey, man, that's a beautiful thing. Well, you know, I played basketball with Reuben Rogers and Peter Martin, and all those guys always tell me that your brother Wenton can play some hoop.
Yeah, he used to. I don't know how he's playing these days, but, yeah, in fact, he wanted to play professional, but I think he was a little too short. He figured it wasn't, you know, it wasn't good odds. And he first started off, we had a goal that my daddy put up. The regulation goal was 10 feet, and the goal they put up was 10 foot 6 inches. So he always had a high arc on his jump shot.
I see.
From getting the hit, having to go up that extra half a foot.
Hey, man, how was it to reunite with the family again, bringing all that individuality back together once again for the Marsalis family reunion.
I think it's great. You know, I think that the thing that's obvious if you listen at for example, Branford's band or Winston's band or my band, my dad's trio, I think that the individual group sound is probably better from our own groups, but the collection of the personalities, I think, was a unique experience. You know.
Yeah. You know, one of the most exciting musical experiences for me was a trip to San Francisco. I went to the Masonic Hall to see Elvin Jones' Jazz Machine, and McCoy Tyner was playing separately, but afterwards they both came out and they played together. And, you know, I know, of course, you were in the band. You're so close to the Vortex.
I remember that.
Yeah. You performed with El, but his last recording was on your album, or his last recording with Horns was on your album.
Right. Well, it was, I guess, Poetic Justice. The last recording he did was with his brother Hank, you know, which is kind of a bit of an irony.
Yeah.
We realized he was 74 at the time, and it was that time. I think, and I know he realized that he wouldn't be recording a lot more. So, it's just he put so much effort and energy into the project, you know, because I knew that he understood the importance. Not only for his legacy, but mine also. And that's just the kind of person he was.
Yeah, he seems like a beautiful individual. I never got a chance to meet him, but just to watch him play and watch him smile and, you know, watch his wife take care of him after the gig, it's wonderful.
Yeah, well, he loves people, he loves music, and he loves being on the bandstand. And it's obvious. And that's how he got that such a unique and such a beautiful sound. And that's what he would always try to bring out of us in the band, was that love for music.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, you know, that's really important. To the older guys, and, you know, I think a lot of guys today are more interested in being, like the sax player I know who always says he's an improviser who plays jazz.
I see.
You know, because they don't really want kind of that, almost that stigma of being a jazz musician. But, you know, I think that's where me and Elvin really clicked, was it's cool to have a love for jazz.
Right.
To me, it's cool to love the history of the music. It's cool to love the older musicians. It's cool to come out swinging. And, you know, that's where I'm coming from.
You know, we hear that, too. You're listening to my man Delphio Marsalis right here on the show, live with the Jazz Cat on 1410 AM KRML Jazz and Blues Radio. Well, you know, I spoke with Terrence Blanchard, and my concern was that many of the young players are influenced by their generation, just as they should be, and they're putting out their projects and taking the music so far in a different direction that the jazz core is almost diminished. Where does the responsibility lie, you think, with that?
That's a strange one. I think
it's hard to say.
Throughout the history, when we mention it's just such a different time period, you know, and I think that the individuals, Thelonious Monk and Duke Ellington, those guys who would be playing music, you know, probably are doing something else now, you know, maybe athletics or the field is so much more open. So back in the older times, I think you had very limited options as far as what guys could actually do from a standpoint of work. You know, I guess they could be Pullman porters, you know, handymen, janitors, or musicians. Mm. That's an easy choice.
Right. Very easy.
Nowadays, you know, there's so many options, but I'm saying that to say the younger guys, they're doing the best that they can, and the ones who were not fortunate enough to play with the older musicians, you know, we had kind of a generation gap in the 70s when guys stopped playing jazz, and then it wasn't until the mid-80s that jazz started to come back around. Well, by us missing the late 60s and the 70s, those are the generation of older musicians who would today be serving the models.
Right.
They'd be in that area, you know, the 50s, 60s, when they would be nurturing the younger musicians. So these younger musicians did not have that opportunity. So in that respect, I cannot blame them.
Well, that was one of the things that I was going to ask you about, too, because it's always been the tradition of all of these legends to, you know, bring on younger band members. And each party, the younger band member as well as the master, they both learn something from each other. Music and education, it would seem, come pretty natural to you. But since you have had the experience of playing with the masters of the music, what do you tell your students so that they can get as close to that experience as possible?
Well, you know, it's just a lot different because I think that my understanding and love of the music was such that I could adapt to where Elvin was coming. I played with Max Roach for a little bit. You know, I was able to adapt to where they were coming from. I think the younger musicians have a much tougher battle because I don't want to say that none of them love the music, but I think their understanding of what was going on is just different. Like, I think in my family, the thing that we really have been blessed with is just to have real deep love for the music. And I think that a lot of that is missing. So the younger guys, they want to play jazz and they like it. They say, hey, I get a gig. But it's just when you really have that deep passion and love, like, that's when the music really speaks. And I think that's kind of what we have to try to get the younger audience to understand, the younger, you know, players to understand.
Yeah, well, I mentioned this to several people I've interviewed. You know, the thing that's missing from the music is the women and the dance.
Hmm.
And when you bring those two elements back, then you bring around another popularity for the music that is missing now. And with many of these musicians not having the opportunity to play with masters, and even they're going to the New School or Manhattan School of Music, and they're coming out and they're just putting out their own records with their own band. They haven't even touched on any aspects of learning from the masters, and then they just go from there.
Right. Well, you know, that's a good point. And a bigger problem we have, I think, is that the separation between popular music and rap and jazz today, it's like before rap music, all of the Negro music came out of the church experience. So even the jazz, even though the churches wouldn't allow jazz played and you had that aspect, the jazz musicians were sympathetic to the sound of the church. They grew up, Elvin Jones is a prime, his dad was a preacher.
Right.
So there was not that disconnect. Rap came along and it kind of followed a European tradition. I think it's kind of the punk rock tradition, which is just rebellion to the degree that they severed all their ties with the church music and with the what came before them. So because of that, I think that there is the disconnect. So you have guys who are playing jazz now, and they see it as such a separate thing. Okay, if you have the rap, if you have the dance music, that's separate from what I'm doing. But it's all connected. You know, and that's what Branford and I were just talking about, how it's all connected.
Yeah, very interesting point of view. You're listening to Delfeo Marcellus on the show Live with the Jazz Cat with Leroy Downs. Well, Minion Dominion, your third release as a leader, man, it's very rich, man. Rich with the roots of the music, you know, while swinging in the 2007 style. You know, there, somewhere, the younger artists have so many discs as a leader. You know, I know one of them was like 20 discs. But you've only got three. What is your strategy in terms of crafting the music, your career, and your legacy?
Well, you know, I you make decisions when you're younger, and I signed to RCA Records, and at that point they wanted to dictate to me who I could use on my recording.
I see.
So I made the decision at that point that until I was in a situation to do, you know, what I felt like. Like, I didn't want to be tied down to, okay, you have to use Branford on your record. Okay, you have to use Winton on your record. You have to use whoever, Herbie Hancock. At any rate, during that time period, Elvin Jones asked me to play with his band.
Right.
So it just kind of worked out that way. It wasn't that I had a design. Like, I was supposed to come out, I had a trilogy. It was three CDs. The first CD was going to be conceptual, based on themes from the Bible. The second was going to be a romance record, and the third was going to be more of a burnout record, or a rebellion record. So I had all that in place, and then when I think perhaps I could have worked out my differences with the record company a little different, but it was kind of a strange time. So saying that to say, it's just how it kind of happened. It wasn't a specific design, but I think that I've had a lot of time to reflect, and my records have a lot of meaning.
Yes, they do.
And it's, I don't just say, okay, I've got to put out X number of records.
Right.
You know, I'm going to make the statement, and, I'll see where it takes me.
Well, the trilogy album sounds like a very beautiful project. I mean, what happens to the music?
Well, it was never completed. So I have to, you know, and then things change. It's like that was 15 years ago.
Okay, the times change.
The times change, the music changes. So, it just was a different, it's a different era. So I have other things in mind now.
Right.
But, I think that I'll get to, when I see Joshua Redman, he always says, man, where's that second record?
I just communicated with Josh the other day. He's playing up in San Francisco the next weekend with a trio I haven't seen him with. But it's very interesting that you say that, and it's one thing that's important for the audience to know is that, you know, artists, it's all about really being organic with the music. You can't go back and force that music of 15 years ago. You have to feel it, and if you've outgrown it and it never got done, that was just a point in time where the music just didn't come out, and we all missed that.
Yeah, or you have to work with it. And I think the easy explanation is, well, he spent so much time behind the booth and he was recording. I mean, he was producing that he didn't. It just was, you know, it's just one of those kinds of things. And like I said, when I look back at how things were going with RCA, and I should have signed with Geffen. You know, the funny story is the guy at Geffen Records, the president of Geffen Records, came to one of my gigs, 1990.
Wow.
And he heard me play, and he called me up 2 days later. He said, I know that you can make great records. He said, we want to sign you to Geffen. Now, Geffen did not have any jazz.
I see.
You know, they had Guns N' Roses. Like, they had the big boy. I was like, well, Geffen. Unfortunately, their jazz was going to be handled by GRP Records.
I see.
And I said, no. You know, but it was just here's the guy, he had the Midas touch, Gary Gershon.
Yeah.
And he knew. And now I just said, I've been thinking about a lot of things. And, you know, now it's time. And that's the great thing about jazz. It's not like he didn't get his records out in his 20s. He's done.
No, it's a whole lifetime of music.
You know, so that's what I'm looking forward to, you know, getting to. You know, my next project is going to be featuring some New Orleans musicians. And I've got some tricks up my sleeve still.
Well, you produced this new one with Branford, and it sounds beautiful. The name of the album is Minions to Minions, and it's on Troubadour Jazz Records.
Yes.
Well, you know, I spoke with Nicholas Payton about what's happening there in New Orleans just recently, and I've heard about other grave news of life outside the French Quarters. As musicians who represent one of the strongest cultural influences in the region, what on earth can be done about what's happening there?
Well, you know, if you want to keep it real, if you want to be real, this is America. Look at our public school systems all across the nation and say, what can be done about any situation where there's impoverished people? Jazz came, the roots of it came from really impoverished people. And when there's a time of crisis, there's really no kind of mechanism set in place to assist impoverished people. So now there's a big push. Let's get the musicians back. Let's get the musicians back.
Right.
But no one deals with the fact that the music did not spring from a handful of individuals. It sprang from their families. So people are not just going to come here so they can play music for entertainment and not have that family support.
Right.
And it's just difficult. It's like no one has a plan, and it's kind of a peculiar situation. But it's in keeping with how I think this country is.
Well, it's important for people to know that musicians, you know, they live there and they have a real opinion on that, and it's great to hear what you have to say about that too.
Well, I appreciate it.
Hey, tell me about the Uptown Music Theater and how the kids are getting the music there.
Well, Uptown Music Theater, it actually deals more with musical theater than music, but we developed a program last year which we figured would help to bring the guys who are still around who can spread the culture to the younger kids, called Swinging with the Cool School. And what we do is we get to classroom with some preschoolers, and it's basically ages 3 to 8, but we had some 10 and 11-year-olds in there too. And we just get together with them in a band, and we talk about the blues, we talk about the instruments, what the instrument does, and just try to give them a sense of where this music comes from. And the kids, I find, are much more open to it than a lot of the adults, you know?
Well, you know, I think we should always teach with music. I mean, that's what we naturally get with our bodies. We naturally feel this rhythm. So if we can teach arithmetic with music, you know, if you teach English with the trombone, then, you know, it would create a whole new world.
There's no question the Greeks had the right model, where it's not just, okay, we just have to have business, or we just have to have math, or we just have to have literature or language, we just have to have music. You have to have all of it. And I think that's what, as I reflect back on the way that my mother raised us, was there was so much diversity. And that's what allowed us, I think, to blossom. Whereas if we had just been the musicians, just play music and just, I think that, first of all, our vision would not be the same. It would probably be much more singular. And it would be much easier to have burnt out on it. Just be like, oh, I'm tired of this music.
Yeah.
But I think the fact that we had that diversity and, you know, Each of our classes was very important. We had to have perfect attendance. Had to do all the homework. And that's what's important, to just get the kids to understand music is important, you know, in the context of, you know, the importance of these other things as well.
Well, good parents raise great children who produce great music, and we certainly appreciate you. Delphia Marcellus right here on Live with the Jazz Cat on 1410 AM KRML Jazz and Blues Radio. Well, you've got an octet performance coming up next month featuring the music of Duke Ellington, correct?
Yes.
Well, tell us about that and where you're going to be.
We're going to be in Minneapolis, Minnesota, at the Symphony Hall, and that's going to be Ellington's tribute to Shakespeare, Such Sweet Thunder. And I've been a big fan of Shakespeare, Shaq, as I call him. I've been a big Shaq fan for many years, and I did a research paper. I recently got a master's degree. And the main research paper was on, you know, Ellington's tribute to Shakespeare. So I figured it'd be a good way to, his original recording as a big band, I'm orchestrating it for octet, and I think it's going to be a great work of art, and I'm going to put, you know, change it up a little bit.
I'm sure it'll be a wonderful performance. Delphia Marcellus on Live with the Jazz Cat.
Thank you, gentlemen. If you would like to get more information regarding the Live with the Jazz Cat and his interviews on KRML Jazz and Blues Radio, all you need to do is go to his website. That's www.thejazzcat.net. You'll be able to see not only all the events going on, where maybe with the itinerary of the Jazz Cat, but also archived interviews over the years right here on KRML Jazz and Blues Radio. So check it out, www.thejazzcat.net. Again, thank you so much to Leroy, the Jazz Cat Downs, and his guest today, Delphia Marcellus. We'll be right back with more on KRML Jazz and Blues Radio on Tuesday, May 22nd, 2007. Show is for locals only. I'm Gary Hamada. We'll be right back. Philadelphia Marsalis' new album, Minions Dominion. Actually, it's about a year old, not quite a year old, but you certainly hear Bradford Marsalis on there on tenor sax and Elvin Jones on drums, along with Mulgrew Miller on piano as well, Robert Hurst III on bass with Donald Harrison also on alto sax. So just a great album. That is the title track, Minions Dominion, on there. And if you would like to get more information regarding the interview with the Jazz Cat, you can go to his website, www.thejazzcat.net. If you'd like to get more information regarding this album, you can call the Jazz and Blues Company store. Just simply drop by. We're on San Carlos and 5th in Carmel by the Sea, California. And we'll see what we can do for you there. We'll be right back with more on Tuesday's edition, May 22nd, 2007, of For Locals Only. We are broadcasting live from the Eastwood Building in beautiful Carmel by the Sea, California. I'm Gary Hamada.